LeanCast, Product Innovation and UX Design with Bonanza Design.
What's up, everybody? It's another podcast episode of LeanCast. I am borderline emotional. I'm here with one of the true serial entrepreneurs that I know. I met him for the first time, not sure when, it was 2014 or 15, in one of these crazy startup events. And he was the only one that was just so active and so on and keep asking questions and trying to hold the microphone. I'm here with the one and only Sergey Soft. He is a man of different hats, an entrepreneur, a CTO, a CPO. He's the one, if you want to get some true gems when it comes to product development, scaling startup, and entrepreneurship. How are you feeling?
Brett, it's an honor to talk to you today. I'm feeling excited. You know, the moment you've decided to run it, I instantly decided to dive in, because it's you know, the same story for me is probably like a mirror for you. We've met a couple of years ago, like, I don't know, it was like exactly, I can't remember, 2014 or 15. And I remember you also as a hustler. Like, I remember your first day, like, you know, you brush up your skills on every level. The way we met, like, I've met like this young, hungry, humble, you know, heavy accented speaking individual with a big dream to build a company, to build startup in Berlin. And I had the same approach. So we instantly clicked and we started to talk. And since then, you know, I see our like entrepreneurial paths are going in the same direction. They're crossing over, but hopefully going in the same vertical.
There is something with immigrants or emigrants. We gotta call the elephant in the room. The today political climate in the Western countries are not in favor of immigrants. But often immigrants are the ones that bring the energy to the startup environment, socio-economical climate, a society. You are an immigrant. You're living in Germany. What is it about us or about immigrants that makes it a different story?
You know, I think it's we're hungry. We're truly hungry. We're coming to environment that allow us to strive, to grow, to develop skills in different directions. But what we bring to the table, mm-hmm. is this natural wild hunger. Like we still haven't realized our potential. And coming to Germany or any other Western culture, you instantly think, oh my God, you know, like there is so many opportunities. I've just got to pick up the vector and go and start nailing that direction. You know, most of the time there are so many things to do. So you exactly how you did the introduction. You need to learn and try different hats until you get that spot where you feel super overly productive. Mm-hmm. And when that happened, hopefully you realize your entrepreneurial potential, and this is what moves you forward. And I think you and me, we have the same asset that many people would wish to have from day one. It's basically this nuclear power that you carry in your pocket. You know, in Germany, we try to kind of like, you know, go green and cut it down. But people is the biggest potential in every modern society. If you allow that to strive and open up their skills, they will bring tons of benefits to the society. And this is what we do, I hope.
Sergey, my dear, I really would like to do a service to my audience, because your entrepreneurial journey is fascinating. I know a bit of it. Mostly, there are a lot of gems in it. So let's just rewind, go back to your first venture. I think it was Clean Agent or something like this. Let's just start somewhere from the wherever that you are comfortable. Or maybe like even if you want to go 5-10 years back, however, wherever you want to start. Talk to our audience about your entrepreneurial journey. Thank you.
Well, it, it was pretty pretty tough. You know, I came, I didn't speak a single word of German. My only way to get employed is actually to get into startup, because hopefully, well, back then the startup was the only environment where you could do something on your own or and speak English. And nobody cared back then if you fluent in German or not. And my first startup was a copycat, the copycat is the right word, of Airbnb Nine Flats. And there I was responsible for building a sales channel. Mm-hmm. And I've realized that, well, you know, everything we do, I could actually do on my own without some special skills and traits. And, you know, what you need is a passion towards something that drives you forward. And I've realized it. I've decided to do something on my own. And my first platform business that I decided to do is a collaborative consumption community platform. So this is something where you could do in your community, help each other with small transaction, get things done. And this didn't work. But what I've learned from day one, you need to trust data. You don't trust any mm-hmm. opinions. You need to trust data. And when I look at my data, at some traction that I had based on that platform, I realized that cleaning is something very common. People always need cleaning on a regular basis. So I've decided to pivot and only focus on cleaning businesses. Mm-hmm. And this is how Clean Berlin was born. At the beginning, it was Clean Berlin. Then it scaled up to 13 cities and it became Clean Agents. And lucky enough, I was early on the market. Right after me, two other players started to compete. One was Rocket Internet. The other one was another venture. And it was clear to me that without raising capital, it would be very tough to win the marketing game. So I decided to get acquired, or basically I've sold the company or had an exit early on, and I've joined Helplink. It was a venture of Rocket Internet. I was vested with them for a while. And from that moment on, I was continuing on the spree of different ventures or technical leadership roles where I was already quite comfortable. What happens after I've started another company, HelloCare? HelloCare was the spin up or spin off from the platform business of cleaning, but instead of cleaners, I had elderly care services. Mm-hmm. So in German, it's called Pflege auf Abruf. So a huge market. When I was looking at any financial models that I was building, I was dreaming of being billionaire in the next couple of years. But what I also underestimated that huge complexity of over-bureaucratized healthcare system in Germany. Like, just to give you an example, there are, or at least back then, there was 126 Krankenkassen, and everybody required a different system of Abrechnung. So basically how you mm-hmm. process the services, and without know-how or strong operations, it was almost impossible to operate. So I've sold this company as well. And then I've tried pretty much everything that's out there in the market. So we've tried building marketplaces for delivery services. I was involved in building a blockchain companies. I've been building new banks. By the look of my scenery, you see that I'm pretty passionate about sports, so I've joined fitness companies, and and I'm constantly looking or on the lookout for a new mission and vision that, you know, how can you match problems and turn it into executable business? So this is what we all do, I guess. Like, if you have this entrepreneurial box, it's like, you know, like once there, always there.
My wife always asks me, is there going to be a stop here? Is there an exit plan here? What would you answer to this?
It's a good question. You know, there is always like a logical stop where you feel comfortable, and you could start transition your energy from being operationally involved more towards being a mentor towards others. Mm-hmm. But I really wish that point will be later on in my personal career. I still believe that there is, you know, there is things to learn, there is things to execute where you could actively get involved and get things done. Mm-hmm. How about you? Do you feel that this point will come?
I don't think so. I think I'm going to hustle till the last days of my life. I love the game. The output, the products, the businesses is just an excuse. And I just started learning about all of this. Like there was a humbleness in your word that say, I still have a lot to learn. And I was thinking while you were saying this, that's like, this man knows to start and scale a startup all by himself. And he still saying, I need to learn more. So, I think it's a bottomless path. It's to me, in personally, entrepreneurship is my spiritual journey. It's my spiritual path. There is no end in the spiritual path.
Yeah, I love it. And, you know, if you describe that with a spiritual path, then we know that, you know, there is no end of meditation. Your mind could go to, mm-hmm. Places we've never been. And I'm getting older. I have two kids. They're growing up. They're going to school. I have to do their homework with them. And I just realize how much of potential we could offer to the new generation and how much new generation could offer to us. There, we are on the edge of this moment of history where we have technology that could meet ideation beyond our expectation. And I could only experience that every day by talking to my kids. You know, when I realize that they say, oh, you know, when we're doing homework, we don't look at Google for answers. We start looking at TikTok because they explain right away what we need to be explained. I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, like I've missed so many things. You know, the way we consume or we adapt behaviors is on the edge of something that we only now able to realize what's going to be happening next. So I'm quite excited. So I believe, Brad, that for you and for me, there is so many new things to learn, adapt, and based on that, turn into viable business.
How would you go about keeping yourself on your toes? Because for me, there is this fear in me that as soon as I get comfortable with something, technology, because of its disruptive nature, it might come in, sweep my business away. I become outdated and I have to start from ground zero again. This is a real fear of mine. How do you see this?
I think that technology or like hard skills, any type of hard skills that we could describe as technology, mm-hmm. like you know, design, UX, UI, like technical development. It's only the complementary tool in your entrepreneurial journey. I still believe that the most important essence is the like intrinsic motivation and energy that we carry forward. And look at this example of, again, looking at my kids, looking at their kids. Everything is available. Like they have any information at their fingertips. But sometimes what they lack is curiosity mm-hmm. and willingness to move forward and do something about that. And what you and me have is actually that intrinsic motivation. So I believe that regardless on technology that is going to be available, we will be in charge to build an environment around us so that we could use this technology towards good. So basically, you know, like making that available for solving a problem. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we're going to be just a consumer. So this is the difference between mm-hmm. entrepreneur and the consumer, is that we also try to create with that what we have available.
When you talk about future and future generation, you mentioned your kids, your kids of kids, and the responsibility that we have towards them. Can you elaborate on this feeling? And I could see that how it would deepen your understanding of responsibility by becoming a father. How would Sergey like define this responsibility towards future?
This is extremely deep question. You know, I've been thinking about this every day. You know, like I always try to reflect back on me being a child and what opportunities I had when I when I was able to learn something. And many times I keep saying, I only wish that I had this time, or I only wish that I had this technology available back then, or I only wish that I had this a mentor or somebody just basically smarter who could have tell me, oh, you know, like you're wasting your time, or you know, you would rather focus on other things that, you know, might be more productive. But at the same time, I think, like, you know, along the way, you know, we are collection of experiences that we gather, like, along our journey. So my best way to give responsibility or kind of accept responsibility is to try to transcend my experience and give, you know, best option for my kids. And I, when I'm saying best option to my kids, is not like I believe in this saying that don't give fish, but give them a fishing rod, you know, like the. So instead of surrounding them with material things, I try to surround them with opportunities to learn. So all these courses and travel opportunities and abilities to mingle with other cultures. And actually, like, we are super lucky in Berlin because we have that natural way to absorb everything that, that capital has to offer. Like, you know, you coming from one background and I coming from the other background, but together we could be super creative. And that's what I try to basically transcend and give to my kids.
That's beautiful. Like, you know, I'm becoming a father. That's why I'm like, I have this curiosity towards your experience as well. And I think overall, as I am advancing in my entrepreneurial journey and more like my thirst, because I think every entrepreneur has this complex relationship with status and wealth. And this is undeniable. And the more I deepen my understanding of status, respect, and wealth, more I'm feeling generosity towards others. I think it's always a start with me. And then the more I can satisfy myself and my needs, then I can look for others. And I think what you were saying about your kids really resonated with me, because I think at the end of the day, entrepreneurship or a spiritual path ends with, okay, how can I give back rather than how can I take?
You know, you touch upon something really important. I just came back from a hiking trip from Finland. I was in the middle of nowhere with a bunch of business people, entrepreneurs from different part of Germany. And they were all fighting with that, what you've described, like, you know, how can you trade status and the comfort zone with this freedom of making any decision you want to do, which a lot of time describes entrepreneurs, like, because they entrepreneurship is basically the samurai path where you deliberately going out of the comfort zone and deliberately crossing all the status quo associated with wealth and associated with the status. And I could feel it a lot. Like I remember my first, like one of the first meetups we had, like I think it was 12 years ago in the Better House. And there was a gentleman from Apple. He resigned after 20 years or 15 years being in Apple as a top manager. And he decided to start a startup. And there was a question like, oh, you know, like you're driving this Porsche, like, you know, you have you have like a super high salary and bonuses. Why would you trade this off and become that beggar that always running off of the money and, you know, counting days if he's able to pay salaries to his first employees, etc.? And there was like a lot of questions from the audience because they couldn't get that. And I think, you know, and I just wish that I constantly learn how to separate that feelings and not being a victim of that material dependencies. Because like the moment you start feeling independent from that, you become mm-hmm. free. And you know, like mm-hmm. if I meet you, Berat, on a street and I wouldn't know, you know, what you drive and how much you make, but I start talking to you and I see what you've been doing, and I know you, I know your journey, I know your path. In my value chain, you're a lot higher than many people that might have, like, you know, higher savings. So just elaborating with that system of value, I guess it's also like it's important for us to constantly train that muscle to have that separation and have, like, you know, else we stop being entrepreneurs and becoming managers, you know, and I guess it's like a different breed.
How it's such a beautiful point that you broke down, and I love to sort of like drill down on this. Like, entrepreneurs needs to be non-conformist. You always have to go against the status quo on different levels. Sometimes you have to carry that stain, or hey, look at Sergey, or look at Bera, they're doing this thing, doesn't make sense. Right? Or talking to many investors and they tell you, hey, your idea is shit. You know, what is it in there that keeps you alive? It's as if like someone knocks you out, you land on the ground, and then you find this really unjustifiable power to get back on your feet. What is it, if you want to react to it? I don't expect you to, you know, give me a true definition. I just want to get your reaction on this. What is it that the non-conformist attitude, or like the attitude of an entrepreneur, what is it about it that that makes it unique?
You know, I've been thinking about this quite a lot as well, because, like, you know, also when you have kids, you have totally different level of responsibility. So you suddenly think, oh my God, like, Am I allowed doing this at all? Like, you know, I better get a good paid job and just settle. And I keep writing on every, like, social intro or social bio that I have, like, I write never settle. And that never settlement feeling, it comes probably out of curiosity, natural curiosity, combined with stubbornness, that you just you want to constantly improve things. You don't want to agree with the status quo. The moment you start accepting status quo, your development trajectory becomes flat. You then going with the flow. And I never wanted to have that go with the flow feeling. I always wanted to have that. I guess if you simplify everything in one sentence, it would be freedom. Like, you want to decide what you want to do and how you want to do it. And your decision, you know, wraps up things that, you know, we're doing things certain way, and you obviously see that they could be improved, and you never settle until you find a way to improve that. And I guess that's in one sentence how I see that.
How do you see the role of risk in your entrepreneurial path? How much do you push it? When do you? I'm just shooting at you different burning mm-hmm. questions. It's really up to you where you want to take it. At which point you said it's enough? I've been pushing it, and now I'm at a position that's unsettling me. What is risk in your own worldview?
Yeah, I guess I don't know where you're getting these questions, but they are so deep. It's like
I got you finally.
I can't get them like straight. I have to constantly think. But this risk, how much risk you take, I see a strong correlation with also how much energy you have. Mm-hmm. So early in my life, and I was absolutely stupid. I don't know if it was either stupidity or tons of this wild energy. I was able to take disproportional risk on my shoulders. And I had some downs, like we all have. You have ups and downs. You're going along the way. And when you have down, then you're not able to take a decision with disproportional set of risk. So you're going in an easy way. Then a lot of time, like the way I describe it, if you look at CV of typical Berlin entrepreneur as we live here, you see people that, okay, they try to raise capital, it works, then boom, you started trajectory, company goes up. Then you fail to raise next capital round, the company is busted. Then you see this entrepreneur suddenly takes a job. He works somewhere else. So he recharges his battery. He gets more energy on board in order to take another, yet another risky decision. So it's a combination of energy level and, this risk. So they kind of like, staying on the stages of the equilibrium. Yeah. And I just wish for everyone out there to obviously have more energy, because like the more energy you carry forward, the more, the more risky you could get in taking some decisions. And sometimes risk is good, you just brings you ahead of a game. Sometimes not.
Sometimes flips you around and shoots you down to the ground.
So oh, yeah.
Stay there.
I was laughing. We also talked yesterday with a friend of mine, and he said, like, how many projects failed? So every time you start a project, I've created like a file in Google Drive, and then that file becomes like a physical folder, because the moment you have UGE, then you need to register that. So some paperwork involved. So I have 16 of those files standing in my wardrobe, and I promise to burn them at some point because I need space. But out of 16, only two were semi-successful. So when I had an exit, when I had like liquidity event that gave me capital to move forward, the rest were most of the time busted. So as you could see, the conversion is not that high.
It's a risky game for sure. And one thing I admire about you, Sergey, is that you like to experiment, you like to take risk, and you like to. I remember when I met you and when you were talking about how you are like validating your ideas. It was pretty advanced for Berlin at that time, and sort of like now Berlin is catching up with the way you should truly validate your ideas. Like, what I would like to just sort of go a bit deeper for you. Like, if you want to now look into a few different ideas, what would be your process of validating startup ideas and sort of like prioritizing them?
Mm-hmm. I think my methodology haven't changed since. Well, maybe it became more technical. I've managed to polish this up or brush it up on edges, but in theory, it's a pretty straightforward process. So, if you and I we decided to launch a new company, we have an idea. We need to validate if that sticks to the market. So, if we have this PMF, like early PMF with some data, and the only way for me to validate that to get some confirmation of data points that it might work out or might not. So the way I do, I've done this hundreds of times, and I've been doing some coaching on that. So the methodology is based about fake it until you make it. So I create landing pages as if, and this is where you come into the game, because your landing pages and your ability to express ideas visually are by far the most beautiful I've ever seen. I truly admire your, you know, your design skills. So I normally, what I do, I take the existing landing pages or landing pages generator with some fake payment processing. So I create a landing page. I describe the business as if I would already have it, as if it's already on the market. I put some testimonials. I put some totally fake presentation of your business in the online world. And then I used to take €500 and I launched this landing page. I would buy a domain. I would pay the AdWords. I would select the specific keywords around my business, and I let it run. Normally, a week is enough for me. So just to burn my budget, €500. Sometimes it burns in the first day. And then I count clicks of subscription or buy now button, and I divide it by overall impressions. So I normally see if it generally sticks to what, you know, if people looking for that, and are they willing to pay for that? And sometimes, you know, with more like clever ideas, I try to swap pricing. So I have this typical A/B testing to see if the product or service I'm trying to roll out on the market might cost €10 or €15, just to have like, you know, an idea. And why is it important to have this buy now or subscribe now button? I try to really count physical attempts to go after my product or service. So when I collected that, I normally start looking at the data. And if the test is positive, only then I start, you know, really going after. I start, you know, pitching, showing the data to potential angels or potential investors. So I treat this as a traction mechanism, because since you don't have a traction, like you need to mimic the traction. So this is how I've been doing, I think, from day one.
How do you define success of your campaign? Like you said, like if the results is positive, what is positive here?
It's a lot of time simulation. So you try to be, you know, cover this golden formula that your customer lifetime value. So the cost, like, you know, the money that you could get out of selling your business or customer lifetime value should be higher than customer acquisition cost. So since I don't know the customer lifetime value, it's a pure estimation. I could say, oh, you know, the user will be using my product for a year or for 2 years. So that's bullshit, yeah? But at least I could simulate customer acquisition cost, because this is the first €500 or €700 that I have spent out of my pocket to generate first marketing campaign, just to see how many people clicked and then subscribed or bought, or at least attempted to buy, because I only count, like, you know, how many times they click on a button. Button doesn't work most of the time. Yeah, and I and the way I do it, yeah, it's probably wrong to say, I do it with a fake impression. Like I've never put a real company, so I always put a Factory Berlin, like an address, you know.
I think a lot of entrepreneurs in Berlin do that.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do that, you know. Well, you want to be at least, you know, create an image that something exists, you know. So we normally name it fake it until you make it. And then after a week, I shut it down, get the data, and then I start following through and looking at if this makes sense. And I must say that a lot of time it doesn't make sense. A lot of time, like, but the likelihood of picking the right idea, picking the right service, is only coming off these early data validation steps. And I totally recommend people to follow through that path, because you could bring some data in a game. Otherwise, you only guess, you know, will it work or not. The most suicidal thing to do is actually build business and only then bring it on the market. So I'm a strong believer that the only way to succeed is to be bold and fast and move fast and break things and try to show something that you want to be selling, like bring your idea as early as possible to the to the early adopters and then the market and the audience. Do you have similar experience with...
It's same, exactly. Like, we try to take it... I mean, at Bonanza Design, we offer this to enterprises. As you might know, they're not really savvy with lean startup methodologies. And it's difficult, especially... I wanted to ask you these follow-up questions, like, for example, so it's... For me, in my experience, Sergey, is that they are not comfortable looking at the data, because, as you said it as well, that it's very rare that that initial experiments would work. You need to iterate on it. You need to see, okay, why is not working. Mm-hmm. Often, what I get from my clients, like, can you make it work in the first try? I really want my idea to work.
Yeah.
So how would you respond to this? Like, how many iterations you think is needed? Like, when is it that you have to call it and say, hey, it's not working? I know it's very generic and we need to have a use case, but like overall, if you want to just like, you know, offer a general advice on this.
You know, I love your answer. You know, like what I've heard a lot, because I was doing this as a, with other companies. Well, being already as an employee in other companies, they would receive a data from the campaign and they say, you know, we haven't reached statistical significance. So the initial test showing you that people don't like it. Yeah, they don't click on that. They don't get an idea. So my normal response is, okay, guys, if you strongly believe and your initial assessment proves, or at least, you know, tells you that it makes sense to move forward. Let's change the wording. Let's change the color. Let's change the segment we've targeted before, but still remain the same methodology, because we need to have a data. We could then prove, okay, we've changed the wording and, you know, and suddenly there is a spike. People love it. And that's what I constantly do. Like when I do my A/B testing, I constantly try to kind of change this and that. But to strongly believe that, you know, market will take it, it's like, it's dead end. Like, you know, like that's the common mistake that the managers do, because they receive a budget and they, you know, they want to make sure that it's going to be working. So they build the product in their minds, not for the user, but for themselves. Like we know that from agile methodology. And then most of the time, they roll out or launch on the market some mobile apps or services that nobody needs, you know. And then and at the end, they try to blame market condition or someone else, you know. So the only way to prevent this is be super agile on your initial tests.
By being super agile means like continue experimenting and iterating to see which one works and which one not work.
Precisely. Like, you know, it's a lot easier to build landing pages and design the product before you start coding or you know, like building physical products like that you're going to bring on the market. And the data that you collect is not going to change. So most likely your initial test on the market with landing pages or whatever, any other test that you do, visual test, is a foundation of successful business in the future. I'm really confident on that.
I can vouch for that, because I learned the whole lean startup methodology by, I think if one, in one of our conversation back in the day, I don't exactly remember was, maybe you were talking to someone else I was listening to, when you said this, this is not the methodology that he's experimenting now. He's been doing this all the way since like, as long as I know him. So I can vouch for that. I think enterprises, startups and enterprises, most of the companies undervalue the importance of making decision, informing their decision based off market data, based off the experiments that they run. They often, it's sort of a herd mentality. Hey, this startup is doing, or this guy is doing, I'm going to do it too.
You know, Bharat, the way I see this is actually like, you know, we need to adapt and we need to coach others all other entrepreneurs to adopt this mentality or mindset where you drop your ego, where you drop your ego to stand behind idea. You need to stand behind mission and vision, but the idea or features or, you know, how it should look like, this needs to belong to market. Market needs to decide for you. So since we can't quantify different opinions, but we could quantify data. And data is the best source of knowledge we could get out of that. So and this is my message to all the managers that you're working with, and they're telling you, can you make it work from day one? You know, it's like, it's running a risk to marry somebody you date on first date and then you instantly want to marry someone. The risk that it's going to be mismatch or, you know, people have different opinions might be super huge. So to prevent that, you actually do this market validation. You repeat it, you're changing copy, you're changing appearance, you're changing, you know, visuals until you understand where the market, you know, leads you. And dropping an ego means not standing behind the idea, saying, okay, if it doesn't work, it's fine, you know, but I got my learnings and I'm going to prepare next test or next marketing campaign with those learnings in mind. Yeah.
So I want to get down with an integrity. If I am an entrepreneur, if I have identified an opportunity, let's say cyberspace or like TikTok-like education app, right, or platforms, how much should I be bringing in for early stage product idea validation? How much should I be having money in my pocket? Like, what is it that is too low? What is it that is too much?
Well, it really depends on your budgets. You know, like obviously, different companies have different ways to validate it. The higher statistical significance you're able to collect, probably the higher the likelihood that you're going to be going in the right direction or setting up the right vector. But I strongly encourage to adapt this methodology if you don't have any money in your pocket. You know, what I want to prevent is to drop A/B test based on individual opinion. So basically, like you and me, we want to run a new app that runs on TikTok and educates people how to do mathematics, for example. Yeah, and there is going to be a short video explaining how to count and how to divide and stuff like that. Theoretically, bring idea, brilliant idea, and then we have two ways to validate it. First, go and talk to people. So we're going to be going, you and me. I'm going to talk to 10 students, and you're going to talk to 10 students, and they all say, brilliant, let's build it. And we're going to start building and then roll it out on the market and realize that nobody wants that. First of all, because we didn't take in significance that you and me, we are charming individuals speaking with a nice, sexy accents. So when we were approaching students, they were already discounting the data based on our individual approach. So what I try to do from day one to scrape it, you know, to not be present in any way that, you know, could affect the data. Instead, I would rather have some kind of neutral flyers or tests. And instead of sending this to 20 students or talking to them individually, I would rather to send it to 1,000 or 10,000. I would try to sneak and buy some mailing list of students. So something that, you know, would really get me data and opinion to back up my ideas. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to say.
That's really cool. That's really cool. It's like meeting your potential customers where they are in their organic environment rather than just like, because like we as the idea owner, someone like told me, it's like a fun fact, when I was a young designer, he said, like, whenever you design something or you put out an idea, put it in a presentation, it doesn't belong to you anymore. It took me many years to get it.
Exactly.
It's like, what are you talking about? That's my idea. I designed it. It's like, no, it's not yours. Move away from it. It's like, I don't get this.
I love it. You know, like, imagine you're an artist, and the moment you put it on a wall, Mm-hmm. You get tons of opinions, and every opinion is going to be different based on your art piece that you put on the wall. The same thing mm-hmm. here. Like, entrepreneur is, in a way, an artist that operates in a digital space. But to be objective and not subjective, you mm-hmm. need to trust not in opinions because everybody express them based on their feeling, but rather how you say, deliver this validation in their natural environment. Because mm-hmm. the hardest thing we have is change people's habits. Whatever they say, they're still going to follow their habits. Mm-hmm. And if we bring a new product or a service, we simply trying to adapt or change their habits. And this is damn hard to do. So it has to be either way better or way cheaper.
Mm-hmm. So or combination of both.
Or combination of both, yeah.
That's beautiful. That it's so underrated that at the end of the day, we are here to change people's habits. And who are we to claim that we can, right? And then that's when the designer mentality, the designer side of entrepreneur comes into play. But you need to test that hypothesis. You need to test that assumption.
You know, Berat, are you an egoist?
What's that?
Are you an egoist?
What is it?
Egoist. Do you love yourself more than you love other people?
Well, I think so. I think it's a healthy attitude. It's like, first of all, I need to take care of myself and I need to be kind to myself and I need to do the best to achieve the desirable result for myself and then for my close family. The way I was brought up, I've been always an underdog. So I didn't have the chance to grow this like a top dog mentality, right? Top dog ego. So I always like susceptible. Like I could always, hey, if you say so, maybe I can do this, right? Then someone told me that, hey, actually using your ego is not a bad thing. You can defend yourself. And it's been a while, like it's been a few years, that a specific person told me. And I think, oh, yeah, it's not a bad thing to be having an opinion, like defend my opinion. Actually, it's an honor for a man to say, hey, this is my opinion. This is my red line. I don't like it. If I don't like it, tell me why it's wrong. Then I think about it. Then here is the humility of it comes into play. If I know I'm wrong, this is my mentality, Sergey. I need to be the first one to say, I apologize. It should not be someone else to remind me, hey, you did something wrong. I need to be really on top of my game to say, oh, shit, I've done it wrong.
Virat, this is exactly why because you ask a question, who are we to change people's habits? And this is like our biggest claim to Silicon Valley, because in the Silicon Valley, they always want to change the world. You know, who are they to change the world? And they're not changing the world. You know, they love themselves. So they change the problem they discover for themselves. So I think we do it. We first and foremost, when we identify the problem that bothers us, that we can't live with, and we apply this never settle mentality, we like ourselves in a constructive way that we're changing that problem and then transcending this to the market, because it always starts with individual. It's probably too philosophic, but I just wanted to find this connection between the, you know, who we are and why the egoism has to play a central role here.
That's a fantastic point. I think it's entrepreneurship is a never ending battle of like checking in on your ego. It's like, am I having a healthy relationship with my ego? Is it helping me or is it like stopping me from moving forward? How do you go about this? Like, do you have this like a reflection? This is a personal question. And I think this is a very deep crash course on entrepreneurship and philosophy and psychology of entrepreneurship. But like, how do you go about making sure that, you know, doing a sanity check with yourself and making sure you have a healthy relationship with your ego?
You know, this what you mentioned, healthy balance of checks and balances, it's extremely important. Otherwise, we're going to be, you know, finding ourselves in a very lonely world where only you think that what's best for yourself. Mm. And community and the support and people that we surrounded with. I remember someone asked me, like, what is the most important thing you've missed along your journey, along your entrepreneurial journey? And I say, you know, like, I'm very sad to say, but I never had a mentor. I never had somebody smarter than me who could say, you know, Sergey, I really feel your pain. I really understand that because I've done this before. I've done this before, and this is what came out of that. And when I look at most successful people, and I just recently I met a gentleman, and he runs like super successful construction business with hundreds or even thousands of people working, and they're building stadiums. And then there was like a man came to visit him. We were having dinner, and they sat down and talked for 2 hours. And I'm like, who is that? And he was like so patient and listened to him so carefully. I said, oh, that's his mentor. And I started to listen, what are they talking about? And it was nothing about business. It was about basic human behavior, decision, things, how you listen, how you respond. And this is, you know, because we are, you know, we're slightly, because we're always solving problems that now our nearest environment might not understand, so they can't advise us. So I believe that we have to be very open for learning from other entrepreneurs. You know, like, it's basically creating a community of like-minded people that truly understand what you're going through, because not everyone goes through the same thing. And I try to basically build that system of checks and balances, that I listen and I reach out when I have like my downsides, and I say, guys, you know, like I'm in a down, like I'm in a valley now, like I don't know what to do, I'm desperate. So, like, and a lot of time people seen this and done that, and they reach out and help. You know, I think what we really need to train, because like we especially guys, especially men, to be able to reach out, because a lot of time we kind of like keep it in a shell. Think, you know, I don't want to show, otherwise people will feel that I'm, you know, I'm not able to solve that. But it's not about that. It's about solving that with a higher level of energy. That's what we all need to have.
You are giving me goosebumps right now.
Yeah, because like we're going through the same thing all the time. That's like
I know. No, I feel you. I never had a mentor. I think men are having a more difficult time to express themselves and like open up. It's something that we need to work on ourselves, take accountability towards ourselves, towards our family, towards our team, towards our society. We don't. And it's something that is, I think, all of us know. And some of us have started to sort of like really not see this as a weakness, but a strength that, hey, I'm opening up myself. I'm calling Sergey and say, hey, Sergey, I'm down. Here's my situation. Like, you know, putting myself in a vulnerable position again in front of another man. I think that's such a beautiful yet undervalued in within men, within us, like, really, to be honest.
So then to wrapping things up, I guess we could say, Berat, that you and me, we are committing to help others as well. And you know, the way you run this podcast, it's also the way to express yourself and provide a channel for others to listen and tune in and say, you know, we're not different. We have the same problem. We're here to help. So if there is an opportunity, feel free to reach out, and we always there to help.
I appreciate it, Sergey. It's been a very deep talk. It's been a challenging conversation. Thank you for doing this intellectual wrestling with me. Thank you for going the corners that some may not go. I don't want to take your time anymore. I would love to invite you for another round. I had a lot of questions about Berlin and German startup climate. So let's just give it a pause. 2 months, 3 months, I'm going to knock on your door. I appreciate it a lot. Thanks, Sergey.
Thank you very much, Berat. I enjoyed it, and looking forward to meet you for the fitness training in person.
Yeah, I mean, ciao, boy. Bye-bye.
Ciao, ciao.